Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 6, Interview with Martin Boozer. Hi, and welcome to the Sled Dog Podcast. This is Tim.
And this is Gina, and this is the podcast that motivates, magnifies, and moves you on the sport of dog sledding.
Oh, I get it, M's, because today we're interviewing Martin Boozer.
You're so smart.
There you go. It took me a couple of seconds to think that one. Okay, well, hey, welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today we've got an interview with Martin Boozer.
And what you would think we would talk about, we don't. So it's going to be really exciting. You'd think it'd be all about the Iditarod and mushing and maybe even some about Alaska. But boy, we covered tons of different areas that I'm not sure that many people know about Martin, so it's really going to be informative and neat for them.
Well, you were right about one thing. This is one interview that will move you. As you listen to the content, what he talks about, and the stories that he talks about, I think both Gene and I both had a lump in our throats as he was going through telling us about some of the things that he talks about. So it's a really interesting perspective that he brought not only to the dog sledding world, but also to a good, wholesome family and character life that he's kind of instilled in not only his children, but also in the world as he interacts with them. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. Also, we want to ask a quick question or any ideas out there. Question for the day is, how do you move 20 dogs? So give us some feedback. We've got, this is going to be a big race season for us. We've got five of us running in the family. We've got 20 dogs. We're running mainly sprint races, three dog juniors and five dog and some ski juring and even some weight pull. But got to figure out how to move the dogs. Right now we've got a, 14 box that we put on top of a little trailer, but we've got to come up with something better. So I don't know, give your feedback, give us some ideas. We see out on Sled Dog Central lots of different ideas. But if you know of anything that comes to mind, let us know. We're thinking cargo trailer and building boxes. We don't know. So give us some feedback.
Another thing I want to remind you listeners is please leave comments on the different podcasts. There's a comment section. It actually says no comments because there aren't any comments in there yet. But we really love to hear from you and what you think about in each interview. So that would be great. And before we get on with this interview, Tim, we don't want to forget Dr. Tim's Vet Tips, which will be at the end.
Absolutely. He's got another great topic today. We're going to be talking about injury prevention and injury on dogs and how to prevent them and how to spot for them on your dog. So he's got some great topics that he's going to be covering with us. Also, I want to give a shout-out to Tim Vandermolen from Traverse City, Michigan, or Lake Ann. Just thank you for the comments and the feedback that you gave us on the podcast. We greatly appreciate it. Also, we'd love to hear from you, so please reach out to us. You can reach us at sleddog@vbs20.com or just go out to www.sleddogpodcast.com and click on the contact link, and it takes you to our email, and you can leave us an email or, again, leave us some comments. So let's go to the interview. Anything else, Gene?
Nope. I'm just really excited to hear this interview again.
Talk to you soon, everybody. We'll talk to you right after, and don't forget Dr. Tim right after this interview. Thank you, Martin, for joining us on the Sled Dog Podcast. And Martin, I guess thinking about the past, how did you get started in dog sledding, and what were some of the things that kind of drove you to get into the sport?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when I listen to Didi's interview on your podcast, how many similarities there are between her and I. And, of course, over the years, we have become great friends. But way back in our early development, we certainly didn't know each other, and now looking back, there's a lot of parallels. My parents too, like Didi's, were quite adventuresome, traveling quite a bit. In fact, my first foreign language I was supposed to have learned was Farsi when I lived in Persia at the time.
Wow.
And always had animals in front of me and around me all my life. Eventually, as a teenager back in Switzerland, where I did most of my growing up, which is, of course, debatable where I'm grown up yet. But I got introduced to sled dogs in my teenage years, and then in my spare time ended up working with sled dogs for and with other people. Eventually, of course, that's what led me to Alaska after my studies and my compulsory military service were done and all that stuff. And I decided to go to Alaska for a year, and I'm still here.
For a year. Interesting.
That was 1979.
Right.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, you jumped right into the Iditarod pretty quick, right as soon as you got here, huh?
It's sort of one thing led to another. My my initial apprenticeship, as it were, was going to be with Earl and Natalie Norris. The connection at the time was the purebred Siberian Huskies.
Oh, interesting.
In those years, the Siberians were the fastest of the racing dogs in Central Europe, simply because the little clause that you had to be a registered Nordic dog in order to race, which mm-hmm. is kind of funny, of course, nowadays.
Right.
So in those years, Earl and Natalie, being breeders of active racing Siberian Huskies, were well known in the European racing circuit. And so that's who I connected with while I was still there. And eventually they invited me to come work at their kennel. Like I say, initially just for a while, and certainly with no intention at all to make the Iditarod one of my goals.
And then the first race you ran was 1980, right?
Correct, yeah. So I guess when I came in 79, I came in the springtime of 79 to Alaska, ended up working with, I think it was over 200 dogs that Earl and Natalie had at the time.
Wow.
And they must have liked the approach I had with the dogs, and they pretty much enabled me to run the Iditarod. They provided the dogs and most of the equipment. Of course, most of the supplies were provided by them. They pretty much were my big-time sponsors at the time. I think I might have come up with the entry fee and maybe a little bit of a stipend here or there for, you know, some of the expenses. But they were truly my biggest supporters. So they made it possible for me to, within less than a year of being in Alaska, to run the Iditarod.
So the dogs that you ran with in 1980 were all purebred Siberians?
Correct, yeah.
And were they the typical Siberians that, you know, most people know, like from the movie Snow Dogs, or were they the Sepala kind of?
No, they were certainly racing Siberians. They were AKC registered dogs, but they were fast. Well, that's a relative term, of course. They were the fast Siberians, not so much the show Siberians of nowadays.
Right.
In those years, they had competed in various races, including the Fur Rendezvous and races like that. So they were, when it comes to Siberians, they were the best ones.
Right.
Fantastic. So then you ran up until, I mean, obviously in 88, you got in the top 10. Were there some different things that happened over those years?
Well, I joke, of course, that in 1980, I ran Iditarod with Siberians, and then again in 1981, I was still at the Howling Dog Farm in Willow and still working with Earl and Natalie, and they wanted to see, now that I had a little bit of experience, they wanted to see what the Siberian team could really do competitively. So that year, Earl sat out from the rendezvous and let me take some of the very best Siberians, I think, ever assembled on the Iditarod Trail. Hmm. And still, we only finished 19th, which, of course, was a respectable finish. But from an ultra-competitive point of view, I don't think the Siberians could or will ever challenge the Alaskans.
Right. So did they make a switch from the kennel side and decide to shift?
Well, no, that was... Then I was hooked by then, of course. 1981, I finished 19, and that was the beginning of the end for me, simply because I was hooked on Iditarod, but I also wanted to become competitive. I knew that could not be done with Siberians, and I also wanted to strike out on my own. I knew I was going to stay in Alaska. Of course, didn't have money, didn't have anything to start my own dog team. So I ended up going to work and not having sled dogs for a few years because I needed to get on my own 2 feet, so to speak. Worked very many jobs, worked real hard for many years. And then in, I think it was 1986 that I ran my first yearling team with my own dogs to Nome.
Fantastic.
And the rest is history. Of course, I ran the Iditarod ever since and finished every year from then on.
Yeah, and looking at those races, is there any particular race that is most memorable for you?
Oh, you know, the race of 91 is definitely a very, very important race in my development. It's the Iditarod that I say I learned to win in that storm of 91.
Right.
A synopsis is the five front runners battled through a pretty challenging Iditarod. Eventually, we got into White Mountain, and it was a relatively calm evening as we were getting ready to depart, but the local people said, you guys shouldn't go. It's not going to be doable. It's dangerous. It's impossible. And it started to escalate. You know, the terminology started to get such as life-threatening or unbearable or unprecedented. Storms were supposed to arrive, yet it was relatively calm in White Mountain. But, you know, being racers, the five of us, independent of each other, of course, we struck out, and they happened to be Susan Butcher, Joe Runyon, Rick Swenson, Tim Osmar, and myself.
Wow.
And I was fifth in row. We had a mandatory, I think at the time it was an eight-hour layover we had in White Mountain, so we felt rested and ready to go. And I was fifth in line. And it wasn't all that horrible, but as the miles progressed, the intensity of the approaching storm also worsened. And eventually, as I was heading into, which ended up not being the heart of the storm yet, uh-huh, I had a head-on. And, you know, as the visibility was maybe 150 feet and, you know, clearly not very good, all of a sudden that dog team is approaching me, and it's Susan Butcher. And she says, well, I'm turning back. I'm going back to White Mountain. And Rick is freezing up there on Top Cock, and he's lost his headlight, and his hands are freezing up, and it's not doable. And knowing you, you'll probably find out for yourself. that was all she said, and she headed on back to White Mountain. And in passing, of course, we're shouting at each other, trying to make each other heard. I said, darn right. So I kept on going, and it wasn't very many minutes later that I had a head-on with Joe Runyon, who had just won the Iditarod a couple of years prior to that. And we shouted at each other some more. He said, you know, it's not doable. I'm going back, and it can't be done, and yada, yada. And, of course, I didn't say anything, and I kept on pressing because the math, the way it works, is 5 take away 2 is 3. So now I found myself in third place, and I was reasonably confident that I could press on a little longer, somewhat hardened by the fact that Rick Swenson was out there somewhere, and if he truly was freezing up, maybe somebody ought to give him a hand.
Absolutely.
So I kept on going and eventually had a head-on with Tini Osmar, and that actually shook me maybe a little more than anybody else, because simply I had worked with Tini for quite a few summers commercial fishing and regarded him as one of the hardest and hardest workers and toughest dudes in Alaska. So when he shook his head and turned around and without a word, of course, we passed each other because he's a man of few words.
Right.
I started to, you know, question my wisdom a little bit, but still the math was somewhat enthralling. 5 take away 3 is 2, you know, so now I found myself in second place without really having done much.
Oh, wow.
And from then on, for the next 27 hours, I was looking for Rick Swenson, mostly because I was worried that something really might happen to him, and it got pretty intense. I mean, it got to the point where I was leading the team. I had Eleanor, one of my trusted lead dogs, next to me, side by side. We literally walked for many, many, many hours, basically crawling along the trail, trying to discern the trail, trying to make it out, with probably a 40, 45 knot wind blowing at a 45 degree angle. The sled was continuously blowing on its side, and I eventually just let it drag because that kept the dog team strung out nice. And I walked, you know, 2 or 3 miles an hour with that lead dog, and we just looked for scratch marks on the trail ever closer to Nome.
Wow.
And, you know, long story short, I mean, there's a lot of nuances within that 27-hour march. But long story short, I got to know him in second place. But more importantly than anything, I think, and Rick happily won his fifth Iditarod that year, but more importantly, I think I gained the confidence not only in my dogs, but in myself. And in the weather, and in my equipment, and in my ability to cope with situations like that. That then, of course, the following year was my first victory.
Right, 92 is your first one.
Do you find yourself having that? Obviously, you're a competitor. Do you have that just that ultra drive as a competitor to constantly push yourself to win, or is it more of a goal? Or, you know, tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to quantify. You know, I think those of us that have been fortunate enough to win Iditarod, we're all type A personality. We're all very much more alike than not. However, because in the pursuit of, you know, getting close and personal to a first-place trophy, we really don't interact a lot with each other. And then, of course, when we sign up and when we get out there on the trail, we have our game faces on. But the molds that we're cut out of, it's very, very similar. Yes. In order to pursue those kind of goals, you got to be, you know, very, very dedicated to your approach. You got to be organized. You got to be tough. You got to be willing to take some risks. You got to be extremely dedicated. There's a lot of attributes that are mandated to be lined up just to be in the ultra competitive ranks of the Iditarod. If I knew all the attributes, I could repeat year after year. But clearly, there's a few variables yet that I haven't figured out, you know, so you just never know. But those right. of us that have gotten there, we're very much alike.
So obviously that race of 91 was something that you've done in the past that's made you successful to the present. Anything else that you did in the past that clearly is something with you today in your success?
Well, I think the somewhat, you know, I think I can say anal on an interview.
Absolutely.
The anal approach of organization and methodical upbringing of a Central European lifestyle where everything is very, very organized and very, very restrictive and somewhat planned out and a little bit maybe too geeky. I think a lot of those attributes actually come in handy when it comes to running a business or a small organization or a dog team or, you know, my organization skills and my hard work dedication / commitment is certainly something I brought from what I call the old country. And I'm very grateful for that. It's, as I always joke or believe, Switzerland is a great place to be from.
So I
certainly have learned an awful lot. I could never reintegrate into the Central European lifestyle, but I'm grateful for the skills and the tools that I have been able to take from the old country and, of course, now to some degree apply in my business here in Alaska.
Yeah, I don't know if they could take you back there. You might be too loud with all the dogs. Wake up the whole country.
Oh, yeah, my chainsaw alone, you know, when I feel like cutting wood, I'm going to fire up the chainsaw, whether it's 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. That wouldn't go over very good.
No, I don't know if you can even cut trees there anymore. So that's
not unless you plant 20 more.
There you go.
Now, just a note back on Switzerland, which actually that's one of our favorite countries. We actually have been to several cities there, so we love Switzerland. But did you ever go back and do any racing in Europe or Switzerland or Germany? Or we didn't find that in your bio.
Yes, like Didi, I don't make a big deal about it. Like Didi, we did the Alpirad in Europe, you know, and most of us don't talk about it because we probably had such horrible experiences we'd like to forget about it. Actually, one of my funniest dog driving experiences was afterwards, of course, it's funny. It wasn't funny at all at the time, but it was a cartoon character-like encounter when I raced up the switchbacks in an Italian stage up a narrow, winding, truly a switchbacking road that was used only in the summertime, and we were to race dogs up on it. And in one of the switchbacks, a photographer ran from the inside of the curve to the outside, and my lead dogs, Stafford and Jim Cooper, they thought he was leading them to where they needed to go.
Oh, no.
They had run Iditarod, and often when it comes to crowds, they're a volunteer trying to park the dog. So my leaders, instead of making almost 180-degree turn to the right, going uphill, they followed the photographer straight out into the middle of nowhere and literally careened off the face of the earth.
Oh, no.
Disappeared in front of me, followed by the swing dogs, the team dogs, and eventually, and by now, of course, I'm dragging my brake and my snow hook on maybe 2 inches of ice on a gravel road. As my wheel dogs careen over the edge, I'm finally getting my team stopped, literally the brushboat teetering over the abyss, And now I'm hooked, of course, and I'm standing on my brake. My hands are in the snow hook, and I can't let go, and I don't see a single one of my dogs. Literally, just like in those cartoon, you know, depictions where the sled is at the top of the cliff and the team would be now suspended.
Oh, my goodness.
Straight down 12 dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
So in my broken Italian, I commandeered a couple of fat Italians and had them stand on my sled and literally looked over the cliff and saw my 12 dogs. The two leaders had just reached the ledge. The drop-off was so steep but so severe that the leaders fortunately were on a ledge, and one of them was loose. Jim Cooper was loose, running back and forth on a tiny little ledge. So I had those people stand on the sled while I was belaying up and down my own gang line, retrieving one dog after another.
Oh, my goodness.
So finally, I had 11 dogs back in a big huddle on top of that switchback, and the white dog was still running back and forth. And long story short, I regrouped, and finally I figured, well, I got to go back down the trail. So I hooked up my dogs, started racing down the trail, had head-on with competitors. Eventually, my white dog had found his way back to the trail, and now I had a head-on with my own leader.
Oh, my goodness.
So now, I'm, of course, like I said, 2 inches of snow on a frozen gravel road, no way to stop. So it took me a while to turn around and started chasing up the trail again after my own lead dog, who now was happily going down the trail. And
without you.
Eventually we were all reunited, but everybody had scrapes and bruises, and needless to say, that was not a very successful Alpirad from then on. So,
did you ever find the photographer, and what did you do to him?
No, I never did. Of course, that was, you know, he probably was one of the people I ended up commandeering to stand on the runners and the sled, so he wouldn't, I mean, without help, I would have literally careened off that cliff.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it was, in hindsight, it was extremely cartoon-like.
Yes. And it could have been, in hindsight, it could have been very ugly.
We wouldn't be interviewing you at this point.
They were telling us about your short career as a musher.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. This last couple of years has been pretty exciting with your boys getting into driving dogs. And tell us about that. How are they doing? And are they going to, you know, is Roan going to be a little competitor for you this year? Are you going to run with them?
Well, we don't know yet, you know. Of course, it's kind of sad that Nikolai couldn't do his one and only Iditarod in his senior year in high school, which is the only way we would let the boys do it, simply because he was born March 21st and was not going to be able to do it in his last year of high school. And he's at the University of Washington in his second year now and doing well and enjoying it very, very much. But Roan, he just turned 18 a couple of days ago. He is going to be able to do his one and only, quote-unquote, Iditarod in his senior year, and that's what he'll be doing. So knowing that was probably going to be happening, we might have retained a few extra dogs over the years just to make it so that he might have a reasonably competitive team for the upcoming Iditarod.
That's very kind of you.
Now, is he type A personality like Dad, or?
He's very much type A, very much. In fact, when we joked that his name is Roan the Clone, it's actually, there's a lot of similarities between the two of us. We look very much alike, except, you know, there's 40-some years in between, almost. But we have a lot of similar traits, and he's very, very dedicated. I'll give you a for instance. Right now, he's still in school, of course, full-time. He trains with me early in the morning. He trains dogs. He gets up early with me, then goes to school, and then right now cross-country running season is in full swing. He practices at cross-country, comes home, and does it all again the next morning. So for an 18-year-old, that's a pretty dedicated, pretty tough schedule to uphold, but it's all part of the game. You know, if he, by virtue of signing up for the Iditarod, he committed to helping not only to go on the race, but to help train and the whole progress of making his Iditarod efforts successful.
That is wonderful. That's got to be almost a dream come true for you also to see them doing that.
Well, you know, there's many dream races, and of course another race we might want to talk about is the 2002 race where I, you know, became a naturalized citizen under the World Arch. That was a pretty incredible atmosphere. But this upcoming one might be very special, too, simply because it's my silver anniversary. It's my 25th Iditarod, and it will be my son's first. So that's kind of a cool, you know, that's kind of a cool bit of energy that might be created by that.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it is absolutely neat. And 2002 was a big year for you also, right? You knew that you were going to become a citizen. Was that an extra motivation for that race? Or?
Well, the 2002 year is, you know, anytime you have a winning year, of course, it's special. But it really goes back, and that maybe transcends more than just sled dog sports, you know. My 2002 victory actually goes back to my 9/11 experience. And we all remember where we were or what we did that particular day. And I remember clearly having been a well-adapted, well-respected, long-living Alaskan. You know, I had been in Alaska for over 20 years. I had represented the state in many functions, including inaugural parades and stuff like that. I was Alaskan through and through, but I was not American.
Right.
That Tuesday morning, I will remember, I was on my way to a Rotary meeting. I turned around after the second plane hit the tower. I turned around and I kept my wife and my kids home. And I said, this is a big deal. And if we were to go to war, because I truly believe this was a huge deal. I said, if we're going to war, and I pointed to this ground, this is what I would want to fight for. The very same day I sent off to get my naturalization papers.
Oh, wow.
Mostly to prove to my children that, you know, coming from the safest country in the world, probably, Switzerland, with a pretty intense defense army and a well-structured society and all that, it'd be real easy to tuck tail and go back there. But I wanted to prove to my family that this is what I would want to fight for. So I sent off for the paperwork, and long story short, of course, you got to study some history, maybe more than your average high schooler has to. End up having to write a sentence in English. Mine was, she had a big dog, and I spelled that correctly. So long story short, I asked for and received a special private swearing-in ceremony by the INS people. They met me at the start of the Iditarod with my naturalization papers and a tiny little American flag to be carried all the way up to the trail, and then the paperwork to be signed by the judge in Nome as the newest sworn-in citizen. So all along the race, of course, we had three things planned in 2002. One was to run the Iditarod. I won that. Number two was to become a sworn-in citizen under the Burled Arch, which, of course, flowed into the first accomplishment. We broke two records that particular time. I happened to run the fastest Iditarod ever that year, the only yep. team that has ever finished in under 9 days.
8:22:46:2.
That's correct. A great number.
Do you know what those numbers are?
Oh, I know exactly what those numbers are. But I also have another distinctive record now. That's the slowest and longest swearing-in ceremony on the books ever. That took over 10 days between the start and the swearing-in in Nome. So,
wow.
Those are the two cool parts of the trifecta, but the third part of the 2002 incredible march experience was what we call the Dorotidi expedition, which is Iditarod spelled backwards, because my wife, Kathy, and my two sons and I, we took our snowmobiles and we snow machined home every inch of the way.
Wow.
So that was the trifecta of 2002, and of course that was a pretty energetic and pretty incredible experience as well.
That is wonderful. You sure the INS, they didn't just say, okay, you've got 9 days, otherwise you don't get to becoming a citizen, and so you just pushed it? Is that...
No, there was no subversive pressure at all.
Okay. Just be thankful. I guess so, the other citizens that are want to be citizens, at least they don't have to do the same thing. That would be a good thing.
Well, now I have to ask, though, so how long after the Iditarod did you take before you did this little snowmobile trek home?
Well, we left the Monday morning after the finishing banquet. We have to be in Nome until the Sunday banquet when people receive their trophies and awards and checks.
Okay, so you got your sleep and your food and you were like, you know, together when you did that.
Oh yeah, we were totally rested, and like I said, it was planned. It was not a spur of the moment thing.
Okay.
Several of our friends, including my host family, which it's kind of like extended family by now. They had actually taken our sleds, as the snowmobiles are called around here, the sleds to Nome from Big Lake. They did a father, some of our friends did a father-daughter trip up the Iditarod Trail, and then that made it convenient for us because we had our snowmobiles there, and we turned around and we took the machines back down the trail.
That is wonderful.
So the friends did a father-daughter trip up the trail, and then we did a family trip coming back down the trail.
And you got enough king crab and butter on the way back to satisfy you?
Oh, it was like a true victory lap. You know, it was the only unfortunate part was that we had only a week to do it because Kathy had to go back to work.
Yeah.
But we had such a tremendous time. We had escorts coming in and out of every village. Of course, the bush pipeline was in full swing. You know, the people knew by then. Of course, I was flying my big American flag off the end of my snowmobile. People knew we were approaching the villages, so they drove out and welcomed us in and ended up following us out and, you know, invited us for meals and the nights. And we could have taken a month driving home. It was just so incredible.
That is wonderful.
You know, people would say, oh, you're going south. You know, we took some beluga muktuk from Shaktulik all the way. We were going to bring it to Nikolai, but when the people in Nikolai heard that we were on the way, they met us in McGrath because we were carrying beluga meat for them and, you know, stuff like that. So it was just an awesome trip.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Highlights were, of course, Nikolai is in part named after the Athabascan village of Nikolai. And I remember I think he was 14 years old at the time. And, you know, the little Athabascan ladies would meet us as we were entering the town, and they would hug and kiss and smooch on the 14-year-old, you know. For 14 years, we'd be waiting for you, you know.
Great.
14-year-olds are not really used to that, you know, being hugged and kissed by strangers. So
no, not at all.
Within minutes, we had a basketball game going in the school, and he had a great time in Nikolai for the first time ever, and then, you know, another 80 miles down the trip, we got into Rhone, which is, of course, the second boy's name, and very much fitting to their personalities. Rhone is a rather quiet individual, and Rhone, of course, the actual town or place of Rhone is a one-room cabin, quietly sitting in the big spruce trees, and it was just neat to see somewhat the personalities of both the places match the personalities of the children.
That is interesting.
That's very interesting.
Now, did you get lots of pictures of Nikolai getting kisses to embarrass him?
Oh, yeah, we got lots of pictures of everything. Yeah, we have incorporated them in slideshows, you know, where Nikolai's we're in the school. And we actually spent the night in Nikolai, even though we wanted to press on some more, but there was just too many festivities going on, so we didn't... We didn't make it out of town before nightfall, so we just stayed there. And then because we needed to get going. Like I said, Kathy had to go back to work, and then we have that picture of Rhone standing in front of his namesake cabin with a big old, and he was only, you know, 12 years old, a little over 12 years old at the time. And he's standing in front of the one-room cabin at Rhone and in front of those big moose antlers and has a big smile on his face, you know, so.
That's great.
So some great memories were made that trip.
Now, does Kathy run dogs with you guys at all?
Oh, no, she's smart. Kathy's a teacher. She teaches elementary school and has, in the past, has run dogs, but now the dogs have gotten too strong and too fast for her. She doesn't feel comfortable with those hard-charging, crazy dogs that we have nowadays.
Right. Well, and I was going to say, I was at your website. Have you released your documentary yet? I heard you're going to be a movie star.
Well, we've done some shooting. It's in the cutting room right now. I think we put together a pretty nice program inside of the Iditarod, and then a bunch of personal stories, just like we're sharing right now, are incorporated with some testimonials from friends that. That's going to be hopefully a marketable product. We're getting more and more visitors every year in Alaska, and including in our kennel, and people get the tour and get some stories told, and they always want to take a souvenir back. And I have a PowerPoint presentation that I share with our visitors, but it wasn't as professional as this upcoming video is going to be, that or DVD, I guess it is going to be, where people can actually purchase that and take a bit of Alaska experience home with them. And that's mainly the focus of that particular product. That should be done here real shortly, and it will be, of course, announced on our website, which has gotten quite a bit of interest over the years as well. Kathy is heavily involved in keeping that website up, and I joke that next year, of course, her fingers will be on the keyboard all the time. Otherwise, they'll be in her mouth, and she'll chew her fingers off for not only worrying about one Boozer Boy, but having two to worry about. Well, people are quite busy, and one way of spending that worrisome energy is her keeping up with the readership or the followers that we have. So when you want to hear some real insight or behind-the-scenes stories, you fire up our website, and you'll get the true skinny on that.
Now, how is she going to be? Is it going to take like 5 years before, I guess, all three of you can run at the same time? I guess until Ron gets out of school? Or
it'd be more like 10 years, I would think. Both of the boys want to go into medicine, so they know they're having many years of education ahead of them, and it just is working out so that Rome can do it at one time.
Well, they just got to figure out how to go to school in the summer and take off that second semester in the wintertime.
We believe the several things, of course. I don't expect my boys to follow my footsteps. You know, they need to find their own love. They need to find their own drive. They can drive dogs simply because they're available here. And through osmosis, they have learned an incredible amount. They don't realize how much they know about sled dogs simply because it's daily dinner conversation.
Right.
But we do believe schooling is more important. Having a fallback plan and having something that, you know, that really defines them is more important than having, you know, taking on your dad's or your parents' avocation. So we believe in that, and hopefully they'll keep pursuing their own goals and their own careers.
And what is that like, Martin? You know, I guess if you grew up as a Rockefeller or as a Kennedy or somebody, you're going to grow up in the footsteps of your parents, and there's a lot of stigma, and you most likely end up in politics at some point. But if you're a musher, how do the children do with you guys? And how is that? You know, obviously Alaska, maybe it's not as a, I don't know, how is it for your kids to grow up with you being who you are?
Well, it just depends. I think the awareness grows as their thinking skills grow. You know, at first I was just dad, and being heavily involved in their schooling all the time, we would get into field trip situation where people would, you know, clamor for autographs or something, and then the immediate circle of friends or the entire class, which just knew me as one of the parent volunteers, would say, you know, as a second or third grader, what's the deal here? Are you something famous or something, you know? they thought of me just being the Tuesday afternoon volunteer. And, of course, then as the kids grew and their friends knew more about, a little bit about the local sports and all that, the stigma sort of grew. But then they started to step into their own limelight voluntarily, and certainly not fueled by us, by running. Each of them has run four junior Iditarods, and they performed real, real well. But I think ultimately more important than sporting achievement is the conduct with which they, you know, perform those races. And if we leave a legacy, to me that's more important to leave productive, upstanding citizens rather than good dog mushers behind. And I think the longer, the more our name is associated with something, the more it is integrity, forthrightfulness, and all that sort of stuff. Less precise sporting accomplishments. I'd venture to say, if you ask a lot of Alaskans or a lot of local people, how many Iditarod did Martin win, and you probably get a pretty skewed, pretty mixed answer, because I get a mixed answer. I hear from people, oh, you're the guy that always wins the Iditarod, you know, and I say, oh, that would be great, wouldn't it, you know? I understand that the public, or at least the local people, appreciate my conduct more nowadays than how many Iditarods I have won. And I feel that as the ultimate compliment, because hopefully that is not as fleeting as sporting results.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. That is, you know, and that is a legacy right there too. You know, the numbers will be there and they'll be gone after a few years, but the legacy of who you are and the character is wonderful.
And that's how we look at our kids. You know, we see ourselves so much in our children, and we're really, really fortunate and really proud to a great degree how our kids are turning out. You know, that those lessons are coming through, and they're starting to shine now that they're, you know, slowly but surely getting to be their own complete individual personalities. And hearing from, you know, getting feedback from friends and associates, that's really quality that people are recognizing in the boys. And that makes, I mean, that's the ultimate compliment to a parent. Now, driving dogs takes a second or third stance to that, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And so I guess looking at the future, what do you see in the future for the Boozer family and for yourself? You know, this year you're getting revved up for a great year.
Yeah, well, let alone you're about to be an empty nester, aren't you?
Yeah, we got another year. We always have a multiple-pronged approach to situations like that. One of the ways I'm dealing with the empty nest is just build a smaller nest. We were fortunate that because I built my own house, we had a pretty big house for the boys to grow up in. And most people, when they have working careers, by the time the teenagers leave the house, they have enough money accumulated to buy a big house. But then you don't need a big house because your kids are leaving. And we're kind of the opposite. We were fortunate enough to have, mostly because I built it with my own formerly 10 best friends, I lopped one off. But we had a pretty big home for the kids to grow up in, and that enabled them to have all their friends over all the time, and that made for a great childhood, I think. And now we sort of build our dream house just for Kathy and I. And in order to pay for it, we're going to turn our big house into a bed and breakfast.
Oh.
The empty nest approach is, well, just building a smaller nest and then hopefully fill the big nest with visitors that come from all over the world, and we share what little we have carved out of this great corner of Alaska.
That is wonderful. So it's right on the same property there?
Same property, same 30 acres that we have by now. And the new little nest has two small bedrooms for the boys to come visit.
There you go.
And if we have a good bed and breakfast going, Kathy can afford airline tickets to go see the boys at college all the time. And we'll make it one way or another.
Now, are you running tours and I guess, different events all year round for guests and visitors?
Summertime's pretty busy nowadays. We have many, many people come through the kennel in various configurations. We have scheduled tour times daily in the summertime, but we also have ever-growing numbers of specialty tours that come for lunches or box lunches, or just to share our Iditarod involvement and our love for the dogs and all that. Dog-wise, of course, it's shaping up to be a pretty competitive team. We again, going back to the 2002 race, there is always some residual holdover, of course, where when you have a bunch of dogs helping you set a record, you don't want to let go of them. And maybe I held on to them for just a little too long, subconsciously at first, compromising the training regimen, enabled to have the old-timers still make the team. You might just make a few changes in training that eventually will find you looking at the backs of some people in front of you. So this year the rotation was complete. The last of the great winning dogs from the 2002 race was deliberately left behind at the starting line, so I would not have any excuse to regroup around some of my old-timers. I think the result is clear that I had tons and tons of problems this year on the Iditarod, but managed to come up with a pretty respectable finish.
Yeah, fourth.
Yeah.
Fourth is okay. It's only the third loser.
Yeah. My daughter was real happy with your fourth. So
yes, we were following you very closely this last year.
I appreciate that. No, it was a really good race. I had lots of issues as the race was progressing, and still finished fourth. And that to me is a good confidence builder. If I used up all the bad luck, then I only have good luck left. And lots of bad luck and still finish fourth, that bodes pretty well for the upcoming year.
Well, just leave all the bad luck at the beginning of the, you know, the race also with the older dogs and you feel
set. That's right, yeah.
So just before we go back to this year's Iditarod, but talking about your plans for the future. So do you enjoy all this hospitality? Is that part of who you are?
I think so, ever more. You know, I used to be a wallflower, not speaking much, but I think I've learned the language good enough now to share some of my experiences. And I think when people leave here after I have, just like we do now, share some stories, they realize that I live a lifestyle, that my job, my hobby, my avocation, the art of dog mushing is ingrained into, you know, maybe 18 hours a day, every day, 365. And if I can share that with people, I think I do the dogs justice. That's what they take away from that. Oh, yeah, Iditarod is not a two-week sporting event. Iditarod is a 52-week commitment to your animals.
Yeah.
And I haven't had a person leave yet that couldn't see that after they spent usually an hour and a half or 2 hours here at the kennel, hearing stories and seeing the dogs, anything from running free to cuddling puppies to being hooked up to a sled and going for a quick spin. So if I do that, I think I do my dogs justice. And, of course, you know, I earn some college money that way. Can buy some building materials and keep on doing what I enjoy most, and that's not necessarily racing the Iditarod, but certainly get ready for the Iditarod and train up the team and build yet another ultra-competitive group of athletes.
And, Martin, you know, the dogs are obviously probably 98.5% of, you know, what's going to win the Iditarod. Is technology affecting you guys at all? Is it, you know, the new uses of different things? How is that impacting you?
Well, I think Iditarod is stifling that stuff a little bit, maybe a little bit too much. You know, there was even discussion I heard that they were debating whether they should make sit-down sleds legal or not. You know, GPSs, for instance, are not allowed. A GPS doesn't make me go any faster or any slower, but it can save my life.
Right.
And any time you spell race, R-A-C-E, that means you try to go as fast as possible. It's not a camping trip. It's not a nostalgic event. It's not a you know, trip back in time. We should not be stifled by innovations and improvements, yet the Iditarod put some dampers in it. My sail is a good example. You know, the ancient Arctic explorers used little sails to help propel their dog sleds, and I started using them on the Iditarod, and eventually now you can look in the rule books. There's a rule that says no sails allowed, you know. I mean, give me a break. If it's blowing, it's blowing just as hard for you as it is for me.
Right.
So by virtue of being a race, I think we shouldn't make too many rules that slows us down, because we're always going to find a way to go faster. That's the nature of the beast. That's why it's called a race. If you want to have, you know, ancient parkas and ancient-looking dogs, you maybe go on the serum run, go on a you know, an expedition, an exhibition or a trip that takes you back in time, but don't call it a race.
That's a good point.
Saying that, of course, the race has gotten much, much faster because of some of the more recent technologies. I think tribology, the science of friction, has certainly contributed quite a bit. The plastics that make our sleds faster nowadays leave the dogs working less hard. I think the greatest advances have come nutritionally. The many, many nutritional research programs that have been associated with the Iditarod have made our dogs better. The super premium diets that we feed nowadays, virtually straight out of the bag. In my case, of course, it's Eagle, which I have fed for over 20 years now, is such a superior product that the dogs can virtually race what I call out of the bag. How easy are my food drops? Just imagine, I slice up some fish and some fat when I want to make them a soup. I make a little fish soup, or I toss them a chunk of lamb or turkey skin, and the rest is ultra power pack. Just unbelievably easy.
That's wonderful. I mean, that probably has impacted the sport more than anything. Think of all the time that you saved over the years by doing that versus, you know, chopping up your own food and so forth.
Absolutely, with the assurance that you're doing the right thing. See, that the nutritional, and my, certainly my 24 editor, the nutritional question was always, do we provide the right stuff? And now we have, finally, we have scientific data. We have professional manufacturers of the super premium diets that make the right stuff. So that leaves me a lot less to worry about and a lot more time to concentrate on training the dogs, selecting the dogs, and organizing myself and my needs out on the trail even more.
Is dog breeding and selling of dogs, do you sell quite a few dogs a year?
I don't sell very many at all. I typically sell 15 to 20 dogs a year simply because that's how many pups I have a year.
Right.
I don't breed to sell a lot of dogs. I breed to replenish my team, and I'm comfortable between 70 and 90 animals. So I have about 15 to 20 to sell or retire every year in order to make room for the next generation.
And do you have do you have handlers that help you with all those?
Yes, I usually have two full-time handlers in the winter time. And depending on the summer program, often, certainly the last few years, I retained the same helpers, and they took, in the summer times, they would take a whole bunch of dogs up on the glacier and work for various summer tour operators on some of the Alaskan glaciers, giving rides to cruise ship passengers. And we always would find a good number of dogs that would benefit, mostly the young dogs, of course, sometimes the really young dogs, would benefit from learning that work ethic of maybe going, you know, 3-4 times a day for a mile and a half jog, pulling pretty heavy loads.
Yeah.
So we would send some of those dogs up on the glacier, which left me with a fewer mouths to feed in the summertime, which then I could handle by myself.
Well, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners and just to give them a little bit more insight about who Martin is?
Well, I think my yakking about the various events probably sparked some interest to some people, and they certainly can go on boozerdog.com and hear more and see more of the stories. And when we talk dog breeding, you know, you mentioned some of the, you know, how many dogs were bred and all that. I think, and it always sounds like I'm you know, boasting my own program, but people that are choosing not to breed and to buy dogs are better off. I use the example of, if you can buy a dog that improves your team, you shouldn't breed.
Absolutely.
It's a lot cheaper to buy a $1,500 or $2,500 dog than to breed a whole litter and not really know what you're doing. You know, the fact that most of my dogs nowadays have 8 or 9 Iditarod champions in their background just genetically makes them pretty darn good animals. I don't pretend that they all are going to make my Iditarod team at the finish line. But they're all great dogs, and they can all go to Nome. And that's one of the prerequisites that we expect from them, that they certainly, in their yearling year, will go to Nome. Most people will never see the difference in the dog that I might sell and the dogs I retain, because they're a half a mile an hour faster.
You know, right.
The quality it takes to win the Iditarod is hardly ever touched by most dog mushers. That's why I think more people should actually try to buy dogs rather than to breed their own, because everybody's dogs have 4 legs and a tail, but you know, ours might just have a little more drive and a little more genetic, a little more superior genetic makeup than most of the other ones.
Well, and Martin, we run sprint dogs here in Michigan, and I tell you, when I was watching, I guess probably Kathy had put it on your website, the YouTube videos, you've got the 3 videos on there, and you hooked up, I think, a 5-dog team and just behind a sled in the summertime and let them run. Those dogs were definitely more than a half a mile an hour faster than my dogs. So it was very impressive, and I don't even know which dogs you used, if they were your Iditarod dogs or just some regular dogs that you had around, but it was very impressive.
Yeah, actually, one of the visitors put that on. Yeah, we were alerted to that we were on YouTube, and I thought it was pretty funny. But one of the real funny experiences I had was we were, because of lack of snow, I ended up taking my 46 best dogs and training up on a big frozen lake about a 4-hour drive from here. And at one point, I turned all 46 dogs loose and took them for a walk.
And they stayed with you, didn't they?
That's a pretty impressive sight when you have that many dogs. Tell people, you don't go inside and have a cup of coffee because something would happen. But it's a pretty impressive sight when you have all those dogs milling around and having a good time on a big frozen lake.
You know, we saw one of the videos, one of the Iditarod videos, where I don't think you had all 46. I'm not sure how many you had, but you walked out and you let them all out of the dog box in the truck, and they all stayed right around with you, and you were feeding them some biscuits. And that was the most impressive thing to me, is just to know that they were sticking around and they were hanging around and they were just excited and happy and friendly with each other.
Yeah, and then we go for runs. Then I strap on my running shoes, even though I don't really like running, but then we take off into the woods, and I call it bushwhacking. Then I go hide myself and have them come find me and all that. That's some of my most favorite thing to do.
And you get them all back. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, we haven't tried that yet, have we?
No.
We got the option. You know, I tell them, if you can find a better place, feel free to go.
There you go. I just think of all the quality of those dogs, and
well, just... if you can make them wander to Michigan,
yeah,
we'll give them a better place.
Well, Martin, this has been absolutely just a fantastic
just
interview
wonderful.
For us, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and our listeners. This has been wonderful.
My pleasure. I think it's a great thing to have those podcasts, and since they don't take up much room, maybe they can be archived for a long time.
Absolutely. Well, it'll be interesting to see if anybody listens to our podcast while running the Iditarod in 08.
I doubt it. Only if we had the secret inside tips of Martin Boozer, maybe.
Oh,
but
that would help boost our ratings, won't it? How Martin's going to win the 08 Iditarod.
Maybe you ought to do that with a list of questions, concise, precise, you know, and then I give concise and short answers. So that could be, maybe it could even evolve as the trail progresses. You know, what do you do in Rome or in Nikolai or in the grass, you know?
Right.
Well, we thought about it and we thought to ourselves, okay, but you know, you guys are pretty smart folks, and you'd probably use the reverse psychology and tell just the opposite of what you'd really do. Or they'd think, well, is he telling me the opposite? So is it, and then you could go back and forth about 100 times thinking, is
you know, that'll get you to know, second guessing yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully nobody will need the question, what do I do in my dogs careen over a cliff.
Yeah, after a photographer. Yeah.
No, I'm afraid I didn't share too much insightful Iditarod.
Oh, no. You know what? It was actually awesome. And I actually am just really blessed by your patriotic stance with 9/11. And Tim and I are extremely patriotic. We absolutely love America. And we try and raise our daughters to just honor this country for what it is. And that's just awesome. I know they're going to love that part of the interview.
Excellent. I tell you what, when I get that story out a lot, and I have grown men cry when I tell that story.
Absolutely.
It's a pretty moving, like the storm of 91, pretty shaping for this family, for sure.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Martin, have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You do too.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Wow, what a great interview. I just was moved when he was talking not only about what happened on 9/11, but also just the way he's instilled a character into his boys and trying to lead, I guess, his family, which is probably a good word to use for that. What did you hear in the interview, dear?
Oh, my mouth's still wide open for the dogs careening over the cliff.
That was great.
I'm just like, I can't even believe he got them all back up and everybody was okay. I mean, obviously, the race didn't go real well, but honestly, I thought, wow.
So
that was really neat, because I don't know that many people know about his European races, so...
Just no, I think that's neat, and I wonder if that, the Italian photographer had gotten any pictures of the dogs over
for sure.
The edge.
Oh, my goodness.
Those would have been worth a lot, so.
Now let's go on to Dr. Tim's Vet Tips, and today he's going to be talking about injury prevention.
Here we go. Okay. Fantastic. So, Dr. Tim, tell us a little bit about injury diagnosis and prevention.
Okay. You know, I think the main thing you need to realize with your dog is you got to know how they run, and you have to know their normal gait to be able to understand an abnormal gait. So if you're not paying attention to your dog's running, you know, each one individually and kind of lock that in your brain, it's much harder to pick up an injury early versus later on when it's really obvious. So some injuries can come on very subtly, and with time and experience, you can pick up an injury much sooner than the dog actually going three-legged on you. That's well past when we shouldn't be having a dog in the team, obviously. So when I look at a dog from behind, we're all looking at their rear ends typically to watch these guys move. That's going to be the most typical way us mushers are going to see the dogs are from behind. So first and foremost, know their gaits. And remember, this adage always sticks in my head. When something's painful, you tend to move away from it. So if you have a painful front leg, when you put your leg down, when they put their leg down, their head will go up because they're going away from the pain. So you'll get a head bob. Okay? When you have a rear end lameness, when that back leg goes down, it's painful. Their butt goes up, their head goes down. So if we have a dog that's normally level-headed running and suddenly we have a head bob, it's going to be a front-end injury, possibly, but it could also be a back-end injury if you're not really paying attention. So what you need to do is understand the head up or the head down with pain. Okay, so I hope that makes sense because I think it is a very simple thing to do. The body moves away from pain, front legs. If a front leg is painful, the head goes up. And if the back leg is painful, the head tends to go down. Okay, so it's going away from the pain. Now, secondly, is if you're watching from the side of the dogs, you can pick this up much easier. It's very easy as a veterinarian to pick up lamenesses on dogs when the dog team is moving because you're looking at it from the side, and you can see that obvious head bob or head down. But from behind, you have to just know how your dogs are normally running to be able to pick up the abnormal. Secondly, once you understand that there's something wrong with the dog, his gait is off for some reason, remember that the guy in the sky made two of everything. For the most part on the dog. They've got two front legs, two back legs, so we can compare side to side and see if we can pick up something one over the other. So if we go through an orthopedic exam, which is basically what we do every time we harness a dog, we start at the bottom of the toes, we work our way up to their ankle, work our way up to their, elbow, and then up to their shoulder. Every time we flex that leg to put a harness on, you're basically doing an orthopedic exam. But you kind of want to work your way up from the bottom to the top. And you can practice this numerous times every time you put a harness on and off. It's just to isolate the joint, meaning you flex the ankle first, the elbow second, and then the shoulder third. And each time you do it, they're always isolated, so you're not moving the other two joints. And when you do that, you can start to notice when you hit where it's painful, the dog will react typically. These guys are pretty stoic. But they'll react somewhat. Sometimes they'll stop breathing. They might turn towards you. They might grimace or, you know, kind of buck away from you. Some dogs are very stoic, and they won't do a darn thing. You'll notice something very, very subtle. And, again, it takes time and experience to be able to pick up some of these very subtle injuries in the joints or the muscles, for that matter. But it's just practice and patience of learning what's normal and what's not. But when you go through that orthopedic exam, you know, on the front or the back leg, practice makes perfect, and versus getting into each individual injury that we could come across, I think you need to know how the dog reacts to you flexing the joint. Just in the normal degrees that they flex their joints. We don't move them sideways and such very often. It's going to be back and forth for the range of motion, and then we can compare it to the opposite side. And notice if we have a decreased range of motion, meaning that ankle doesn't flex as far as the right wrist, the left wrist is much more stiff, or the shoulders for that matter. We take the legs forward, we take the legs back. Again, trying to isolate those joints to really find where the dog reacts to. And then once we know that he's reacting, let's say, with an ankle flexion, then we can try to isolate it on the ankle as to where the injury might be. But again, you got to know what the normal is to know the abnormal. And I think that's number one, two, and three keys with injury diagnosis with these guys is knowing how, number one, they're running, you know, their normal gait. Number two, once you do understand that their gait is off, trying to identify the area that is painful. And then thirdly with these injuries is once you do understand there's an injury, you got to lay them off in a lot of instances. And it's always good to consult with a musher that's been doing it for a while to see what kind of layoff you might need. You know, with the wrist, you might need 10 days off. With the shoulder, you might need 3 weeks to get these guys better. Again, it depends on the level of injury. You might need medication and so on and so forth with that one. But as a real simple thing, just know what's normal to be able to understand the abnormal.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. That was great. Hey, well, thank you so much for listening to this show. We truly appreciate all the wonderful feedback we're getting, the comments that people are leaving in our email, and also handwritten notes. We totally appreciate it. I want to say thank you so much for Martin for coming on the show and letting us interview him, and also for you guys for being there for us and listening. Again, if you need us at all, go to www.sleddogpodcast.com. And next week's show, we have an interview with a distance musher, which we'll talk about not only how to grow a kennel, but also different things to look for in the dogs and how to
transition from going to sprint races to mid-distance to long-distance races like the Bear Grease and how you go about doing that. It's a great interview. So look up for that one. As soon as we can get it edited, we'll have it to you.
Till then, have a wonderful week.
Be blessed now.
Take care.